Okay, so this is Bio 160, and it is August 21st. We're going to finish up Chapter 1, move on to Chapter 2, and then what else do we have this afternoon? Your first quiz, and you need this Scantron. You need a pencil and a good eraser for that first quiz. And the quiz is coming from the Student Study Guide, which is this really nice book right here. The Mastery Test section only of this book right here for Chapter 1. Okay. Now the nice thing about quizzes, you get to drop two. So if you're not prepared, that's not such a big deal this first time around. Let's see. So, on the floor here are the things I passed out last time, the notes for Chapter 1, the syllabus, and your weekly study plan. If you want to show me your weekly study plan today after class, that would be great. If you want to ask me something about it, maybe you can't get all those hours that we suggested. How many hours? 12 hours? 12 hours? You know? Nine? Oh, 9 hours. All right, 9 hours. Okay, 9 hours. Ah, you got to get those 9 hours in. That's not too many. That's hardly an hour a day. A little bit more than an hour a day. All right, for this class. Okay, so does anybody have any questions over what we covered so far in class? I think we're doing pretty good. Yeah.
The level thing, like building blocks.
Yeah.
Kind of different in the book.
Yeah.
We went over, so if we put that, would that still be correct? Because
it will be similar enough to questions that I would ask. Okay. And I'm not going to ask you to write any written questions, so I don't think there will be much of a confusion. I think you'll be able to see which way to go with those building blocks. Okay. Okay. All right, so let's see. I did want to finish just a couple things up. Yeah, that's okay. I messed up your organization there a little bit. Yeah. All right, so we talked about the difference between anatomy and physiology. So that's a good review. What's anatomy?
Structure.
The study of structure, and physiology is the study of function. Yeah, that's a good one to know. And we learned that hierarchy of structural organization. So what is a building block of a cell?
Organelle.
Yeah, that's real good. And let's go the other way. If you put a bunch of cells together, okay, very good. You're reading my mind. That's excellent. Okay. And what's the best way to think of building block for a whole organism? The organ system. Right, the organ system, like the digestive system, respiratory system. We put all those systems together, you get the whole organism. And I think we talked about the cell maybe a little bit, but I think we might talk about it a little bit more in the third chapter. But what is the cell the building block of, besides a tissue? It's life, that's right. That's the cell theory of life. And anything that's alive has to be made out of cells. And if it's not made out of cells, then it can't be alive. So another good way to think of the building block of life, you want to say, that's a cell. All right, so that concept of building block is pretty important. Let's see if we get this. Oh, it's not plugged in. Okay, good. Wow. For chapter one? Oh, for today. Who's got some extras for today? Are there any extras notes for today? Chapter two up there anywhere? There should be. Or pass them down to the front. Yeah, here they come. They're coming down. Okay. What the organ system has a very strange name that you've never heard of before? You've probably heard of... That's right, the integumentary system, or the integument. And that is your skin and hair and nails. Those are accessory structures. Okay. And I think we talked about all these directional terms, like the front of your body is called the... anterior part, and anterior's got another name. What's another name for anterior? Ventral. It's actually ventral. The dorsal. What's another name for dorsal? That's a posterior part. Yeah. So sometimes you got to really think about those things before you say it. I know I do sometimes. I'm really familiar with anterior, posterior, but when I say ventral and dorsal, I have to stop just half a second and think that I'm saying it right. Okay. So here's module two. Anybody need module two? I'll put it here so you can pick them up after class if you need those. Okay, let's see. So we talked about all this kind of stuff, different cavities. We talked about the mediastinum, I believe, last time, right? Okay. So let's talk about homeostasis. And maybe I mentioned this, I'm not quite sure, last time I did. But I want to go over specifically some parts of a response loop that I don't have a transparency of, but you have an outline for a response loop in your notes. And I just want to make sure that you can see the different parts of a response loop and how it corresponds to a figure, an actual figure. So homeostasis is very important because if your body can maintain homeostasis, you're going to be in a healthy state and you can stay alive. If your body loses homeostasis, all right, you'll be in a disease state and you could lose your life as a result of that. So homeostasis is a condition in which body functions, like your heart function, right, your breathing function, fluids, and other factors of the internal environment are maintained within a range of values suitable to support life. So that's what's real important here, is to realize that your body is not constant, right? It's homeostasis works when physiologic parameters are maintained within a range of values. There's going to be a normal range that you're going to be able to live within. All right. So what important physiologic parameter maybe could you think of that's not on this list right here? And I want to use that as an example. What's something important that's regulated in your body that probably you're very familiar with, even as a little kid, okay, that your body regulates all the time? For instance, your temperature. Exactly right. Body temperature. So you all know that your body temperature should be about 98.8. And is that the same as the room right here?
No,
it's a lot different, right? So you're not really anything like the environment, because the environment is not alive. Everything inside you is alive and is pretty special in terms of pressure and temperature, pH, and water balance, all that kind of stuff. All right, and your body temperature fluctuates a little bit. It's not absolutely 98.8, even though you don't have disease, even though you don't have an infection or something. So if you were to run up the stairs, start running up the stairs and down the stairs, up the stairs, what do you think would happen to your body temperature as you're using those muscles? It would rise, right? So your body temperature would go up, and then what would happen? Would it still keep going up and up and up and up?
No.
Or what would happen?
It would
start to go back down because other things would happen inside your body to make that temperature change go back down to that normal value. And what would that be?
Sweat.
You'd start sweating, right? You'd start perspiring. And when that water evaporates from your body, then that evaporation will cool you down. Okay. So in homeostasis, there are two kinds of feedbacks that are possible. There's something called negative feedback and something called positive feedback. And I want to give you these definitions, and then we'll look at these definitions in a real scenario so we can appreciate what that really means. So negative feedback is some body mechanism by which any change from a normal and ideal value is made smaller or resisted. That's negative feedback. When something changes in your body, negative feedback is a mechanism that changes it back to where it should be. Positive feedback, on the other hand, is sort of the opposite thing. It's a body mechanism by which any change from an ideal normal value is made greater. So if we were to think of temperature, and let's see what kind of feedback mechanism was working to maintain our health. We start walking up or running up and down the stairs, our body temperature increased, all right? And then we start sweating, and what kind of feedback mechanism is operating that causes your temperature to go back down to normal? That's right, that would be negative feedback. So negative feedback is the good kind of feedback that maintains a good, healthy state for you. And you'll see why they call it negative feedback in just a second. But, for instance, let's think of positive feedback. Let's just say you started running up and down the stairs and your temperature increased. If a positive feedback mechanism were to take hold in your body, as your temperature increased, what would the positive feedback mechanism do with your body temperature? It would make it go up. And if positive feedback was still working, what would happen to your body temperature? it would go up some more, and then it would go up some more, and up some more, and up some more, right? And that would be a terrible disease state to be in, because after a certain period of time, of course, we just burst into a ball of flames, right? So that would be terrible. Sort of kidding about the ball of flames. But nonetheless, your body temperature would go up so high that you would actually die as a result of that. And that actually happens to some people, especially football players, like this time of year when they start practicing on the football field. Okay, and it's happened to high school football players and college football players, even professional football players. If they don't stay well hydrated, if they stop sweating, the temperature inside them gets so hot because they're exercising so vigorously that they can die of hypothermia. Right, so that's certainly possible to do that. So positive feedback will produce a disease state. Negative feedback will produce a healthy state. So this is a typical response loop that we have, that we're going to look at. And a response loop always starts with a stimulus of some kind, and it's going to go through this little cycle right here, and it's going to end in a response. Start with the stimulus and end with a response. So in order for your body to detect something in the environment, what does your body need? That's right. It needs a receptor. So, for instance, if you want to hear sound, you have to have ears. If you want to be able to appreciate light, you need eyes, right? If you want to appreciate temperature, you need to have temperature sensors in your body. And do you have a lot of temperature sensors in your body? All over the place, right? Because if I take an ice cube and put it on your elbow, you could tell me. Or in the back of your neck, right? Belly button, kneecap, wherever. Ankle, you can tell me. So you got temperature receptors all over your body, including inside your body. You don't really monitor those. You're not conscious of those temperature receptors, but your brain is, and is monitoring your temperature all the time. So a stimulus can only be appreciated by some kind of receptor in your body. And the receptor then is going to send a signal to some kind of control center, and that is usually your brain. And the control center for temperature is way deep inside your brain in a place called the hypothalamus. Maybe that's not so important right now. But the signals then, for instance, if you have a temperature receptor on your skin, how does that signal go to your brain? There's a nerve that takes that signal all the way up to your brain. So here is a nice sensory nerve. Sometimes that sensory nerve, maybe I have this on your lecture notes, sometimes when we say sensory, that's the same thing as afferent. An afferent nerve, that just is bringing information into your brain. And in the brain, there is a set point. The set point is the ideal value for your body temperature. And you probably know what that value is. What's the value of the set point for body temperature in our brains? Yeah, 98.006. Yeah, somewhere in there. Okay, 98.6, that's the set point. And the control center is going to compare the number that it gets from the receptor to the set point. And if the numbers are exactly equal, what does the control center have to do? You know what? Absolutely nothing. It's happy because there's no error. You're at the temperature that you should be. But let's just say you're exercising and now your temperature is 101 and the set point is 98. Guess what? This control center right here has got to make a decision on what to do and change something about your body so that your temperature doesn't keep going up. So the control center makes a decision, right? And it sends that decision out to your body. So this is what we call a motor neuron. It's going to change something in your body, or a motor nerve. That's the same thing as efferent. That's an efferent nerve. It's going to send a signal to an effector. And in this particular case, if you're too hot, what's the effector going to be? It's a gland, like a sweat gland. And it's going to cause that sweat gland, it's going to tell the sweat gland to start secreting sweat, and that's going to cool you down. And that's going to cause a response. So the response, in this particular case, when you start sweating, what happens to your body temperature when you start sweating? Does your temperature increase or decrease? Okay, so I'm going to say decrease temperature right here. What was the initial stimulus?
Running.
Yeah, running, which did what to your body temperature?
Increase.
It increased temperature. So the stimulus is an increase in temperature. The response is a decrease in temperature. Right? And so notice that the sense of this temperature change is different from the stimulus to the response. When we combine the stimulus and the response, what happens to them? Do they add together or do they subtract from each other? Okay, because they're in opposite directions right here, they subtract from each other. Okay? So the response is a decrease in temperature and the stimulus is an increase. They counteract each other. They subtract from each other. And when they subtract from each other, right, we would use a minus sign. And so we call that negative feedback. Okay? So let's just consider a pathological condition. Let's just say you started exercising and your body temperature increased and went through this response loop. And for some reason, the response was to increase body temperature under a pathological condition. So now what's the sense of the stimulus and the response? It's the same, and so they add together, and they call that positive feedback. And that positive feedback is a disease state, and that certainly will hurt you or could kill you. Okay? So negative feedback is when the response subtracts from the stimulus, and it brings you back to where? Where does it bring you back to? Where does it bring that physiological parameter back to? Back to normal. And in particular, it brings you back to this term right here, which is what we call the set point. The set point. It brings you back to the set point, which is the ideal value that you should be operating at. All right, so here's an example for temperature, but that's going to happen for all kinds of parameters in your body, your blood pressure, for instance, and your blood glucose levels, and various hormone levels, and everything that your body needs in order for you to maintain a healthy state. So negative feedback, namely when response is opposite from the stimulus, that maintains homeostasis. Okay, positive feedback does not maintain homeostasis. It drives your body farther and farther away from the set point. And then eventually you could die if that isn't changed. Yeah.
What would be an example of positive feedback like in real life?
Okay. There is one kind of terrible condition other than hyperthermia that we talked about. Say you got into a car accident or something, and or a motorcycle accident, and you started to hemorrhage, you cut a blood vessel, and what happens then is that you lose blood, right? It comes out of your body, and there isn't a lot of blood going back to your heart, and when that happens, your heart gets weaker. And when the heart gets weaker, it's not pumping very much blood. But you already, what, are losing blood. You already have lost a lot of blood, so you don't have blood going to your body, but now your heart is getting weaker as a result of that. And since your heart's not pumping blood, you have less blood coming back to it, so it gets even weaker and weaker and weaker and weaker, and it's a very dangerous condition to be in. So what we'd like to do, for instance, on the way to the hospital, even if somebody has had a hemorrhage due to some kind of trauma, even though we don't have blood to transfuse in an ambulance, we still like to increase their blood volume so we can even just give them saline solution. We just give them some kind of fluid that helps their circulation. More the fluid comes back to the heart, and the heart gets stronger. So it pumps more blood, which means more blood comes back to the heart, and the heart gets stronger, and we can maintain somebody's life for a short period of time that way. Okay, but positive feedback would be when less blood comes back to the heart, it gets weaker, which means less blood is coming back. The heart gets even weaker still, and people then go into shock when that happens. Okay, so that could be a pretty good example. You know what? There are a couple mechanisms that rely on positive feedback that are normal, that produce a healthy state, right? And there's only a few. I only know a handful, for instance. And let's maybe just talk about those. We'll see, though, that something drastic happens during that positive feedback cycle to stop that cycle from happening. And childbirth is one of those examples. So you have a baby growing in utero, in somebody's uterus, right? And as they're growing, okay, they get really big. What happens to the stress level of that baby when it starts to get really big? Because the uterus can only get so big. The stress increases because the baby is really stressed. It can't move around, all right? So, and it releases a hormone, and that hormone goes to the mother, and the mother then releases her own hormone as a result of the hormone from the baby that's undergoing stress. And that hormone is called oxytocin. And oxytocin causes smooth muscle to contract, and the uterus is made out of smooth muscle. So the mother's hormone is going to tell the uterus to do what? To contract. And what effect does that have on the baby? Does that relieve the stress or make the stress on the baby increase? It increases the stress on the baby, so the baby releases stress hormones. The stress hormone tells the mother's body to release oxytocin, which does what? Causes the uterus to contract more, which causes more stress, which then causes more contractility in the uterus, which then increases the stress. And so everything is increasing, 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 and the uterus is contracting a lot, and the baby's very stressful. But that's okay, because what happens? All of a sudden, the baby's in the outside world, right? So that positive feedback is stopped rather abruptly and in a very healthy way. Okay, so
would oxytocin increase the oxytocin, or would it stimulate the oxytocin release?
Oxytocin, I'm not so familiar with the pitocin that you're speaking about. Okay. I think that's the same thing. I think that's the same thing as oxytocin, okay. Maybe a little bit different form of it. But that's not coming from the baby. A hormone called ACTH is coming from the baby. Right.
No, I just mean because when they want to, start labor, they give a patient pitocin.
Okay, that's the same thing as oxytocin.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that will start uterine contractions. Right. Yeah. Yeah, because there comes a point in time when you have to deliver that baby. It just can't stay inside you all the time, right? So then labor is induced. So that's a good example of a positive feedback mechanism that's normal, that happens, right? But it can't go on forever, and positive feedback mechanisms stop, in that particular case, abruptly during delivery, or if it's an abnormal situation, then death of the individual, okay? So something radical has to change. Okay, so I think I'm done with this particular chapter right here. And at this point, what I like to do for every chapter that we're studying, notice that you have some questions at the end of the handout. And it's really nice for you to start to fill these things in, even as we're going through lecture, or review them again after lecture. Right, that's what that weekly study plan is for. And so you see the instructor study guide right here. And on this particular chapter, there's only 8 questions. And these are the questions that I derive the test from. So if you're familiar with these questions right here, then you're probably going to do really good on the test, as long as you're studying them and you're kind of familiar with them. So the first question, I'll get to your question in just a second. Okay, the first question right here, it says, be able to define anatomy and physiology. So I'm sure on a test I'm going to say, what is anatomy? And one of the answers would be, it's the study of structure of the human body, okay, as opposed to some other kind of thing. All right, so the study guide is real important. When I write the test, I just look at these questions and I think of a good question to ask, just to make sure that you know that kind of stuff, right? All right, so let's just do number 1. And what's handy is, since I'm recording the lecture, you can correct your notes just by going back and listening to the lecture on your computer or MP3 player or whatever. All right, so be able to define anatomy. Anatomy is the study of structure. And physiology, that's the study of function. And we know that they are related to each other, okay, but they're really 2 different fields. Know the levels of organization. So, yeah, what's the most basic one?
Atom.
All right, and it's also what? The smallest one, the smallest particle. And if we put atoms together, we get Molecules. We put molecules together.
Macromolecules.
Okay, yeah, you can get macromolecules. And if we put macromolecules together,
cells.
And sometimes between molecules and cells, I put organelles, right? So sometimes, because we're going to talk about organelles, these are little pieces within a cell that have a particular function. Yeah, organelle. Organelle, so macromolecule goes to organelle, goes to cell. So an example of an organelle maybe you've heard of is mitochondria or nucleus. These are much smaller than a cell. They give a cell a particular function. Okay, and if we put cells together, we get a tissue. And if we put different tissues together, we get an organ. Put different organs together, we get an organ system. And if we put all the organ systems in your body together, then we get the whole organism. All right, so that's the organ system level. Know the terms homeostasis. Is it good to maintain homeostasis in your body?
Yes.
Absolutely, because without it, you can't stay alive, right? Know the organ system. Oh, I guess I skipped over that. I tell you what, let's go back to three. Know the organ systems of the body and some organs they contain. What's the hardest one? Integument. Skin. Okay. What are some things that the skin contains or the integument contains? Hair, nails, that kind of thing. What about digestive system? Stomach, small intestine, large intestine, liver, mouth even, teeth, right? Things like that, part of your digestive system. All right. What's another good organ system? What's your favorite? Skeletal system. Okay. What's a good part of a skeletal system? Like the femur in your thigh, okay, for instance. Okay. Let's go to number four, homeostasis. Homeostasis is homeostasis maintaining physiologic parameters in your body at a constant level?
No.
Or is it just allowing small fluctuations in these things?
Small
fluctuations. And I think maybe I do want to say just a little bit about that, because think about running up the stairs again. Your body temperature increases, and how does your body compensate for that increase in temperature? You start to sweat, right? So you start to lose water as a result of that. And water balance is an important physiologic parameter. So now your water balance is disturbed a little bit, but it's cooling you down. And then after you exercise and you're cooled down, guess what kind of sensation you have? You have a sensation that you're thirsty, right? So your water balance changed a little bit to cool you down, but not so much that you became dehydrated. And then you compensate for that by drinking more water, right? Because you have that sensation that you're thirsty. Okay, so homeostasis doesn't maintain everything absolutely constant. It lets things change a little bit, but not by a lot. Only a little bit, so that you don't get sick. Okay. You have negative feedback and positive feedback. Which one usually produces a normal, healthy state?
Negative
feedback. And that's because why? The response does what to the stimulus? The response in the response loop subtracts from the stimulus. So if a stimulus was an increase in blood pressure, the response would be to bring it back down to normal. As a matter of fact, to the set point. So what about the parts of a response loop? What kind of parts do we have? Response loop always starts with a stimulus. All right, a stimulus, which is picked up by a receptor, which sends the signal via a afferent pathway or sensory. We could say sensory here. To, for instance, the brain, but we just call it generally the control center. Yeah, control center. And the control center is special because it has a special number. What's that special number, that special value called? The set point. And the set point for temperature is at 98.8, right? It has a, the control center has a set point. The control center then has to make a decision on what to do. It sends that decision out through not a sensory pathway, but a motor or efferent. Efferent nerve. So we're going to call that motor. And that's going to end up, I have to come back the other way. Yeah.
Do you want to know the two terms, efferent and efferent, or is nerve sensory?
Sensory nerve, afferent, yeah, you know both of them.
Okay.
By the end of the class, you're going to have to know both of them anyway. Okay. It will be easier when we get to nerves. Okay, so the efferent nerve sends a signal to what? An effector. An effector, which then produces a the response in the individual. And if this response subtracts from the stimulus, that's what we call negative feedback. If the response adds to the stimulus, that's what we call positive feedback that drives you farther and farther away from set point. If it's negative, it drives that parameter back to the set point and maintains health. So that's a nice response loop. That's a real powerful way of thinking about how your body operates. All right, know what anatomical position is. What's anatomical position? No. No. Not like that at all. What's anatomical position? Hands down by your sides. Yeah, like that.
Thumbs out.
Ah, thumbs out. That's right. That's right. That's it. I know you weren't showing me anatomic position. Okay, you were asking me a question. Okay, so what's your question? Is it still a good question?
No.
I answered it? Okay. So anatomical position, hands down by your sides, thumbs pointing out laterally. Okay, out to the sides means laterally. Know your directional terms like anterior, posterior, proximal, and distal. What about your knuckles and your fingers compared to your wrist? The knuckles are what compared to your wrist? You know what? They are distal. They're farther away, distal to your wrist. What about your heart to your integument? Your heart is, okay, well, I'm thinking of either deep or superficial. Your heart is deep compared to your integument, which is superficial compared to your heart. What are some other things? Anterior, posterior, that's pretty easy. Oh, cranial and caudal. Nose compared to your belly button. How's your nose?
Cranial.
It's also superior. It's superior. Your belly button is inferior, meaning below. Okay. So those are some directional terms. Know the body planes. Okay, three body planes. This one right here, separating right and left.
Sagittal.
The body plane that's separating superior, inferior. Transverse. And then the last one is separating anterior from posterior. That's a coronal, or sometimes we call that frontal plane. Sagittal separates right and left. Transverse separates superior, inferior. Okay. And coronal, anterior, posterior. Okay. Ah, mid-sagittal is a special case of sagittal. So here's a sagittal. Mid-sagittal means not off to the side. It means right smack dab in the middle. And there's only one that's right smack in the middle of your body. Okay? So if it's off to the side, sometimes we call that, you want to know? We call that parasagittal. It's not in your book. But parasagittal is anywhere out over here or out over here. Mid-sagittal is only one, right smack in the middle. Okay? Okay. All right. Know the body regions.
Anterior and posterior.
All right. Body regions. Like... that figure, oh, you know what? I didn't go over that very much in lecture, but I think you just have to kind of look that over on your own and know these. Like crural. Okay, body regions. Your ear is what we call otic. And the region around your eye.
Orbital.
Orbital or optic.
Optic.
Okay, nasal. Your armpit. is axillary. Okay. Inguinal, your groin. Okay. Your arm is brachial. So you just have to look at that figure and practice labeling that figure. And body cavities. The last one are the body cavities. The two main ones are the ventral body cavity and the dorsal body cavity. Let's start with the dorsal first, because that's the easiest one. There's only two sub-cavities in that. You got cranial and vertebral in the dorsal. But in the anterior body cavity, we got to break that down into some smaller ones. You got thoracic cavity, and then abdominal cavity, and then pelvic cavity. And abdominal and pelvic sometimes go together, so we call that abdominopelvic cavity. The thoracic cavity we break down into other little smaller cavities, like the cavity that your heart is in. Okay? Just your heart, not the thymus gland or great blood vessels coming off the heart, but just the heart itself is called the pericardial. Okay? But then there's a cavity that the pericardial cavity is in that's separating the lungs from each other. That's the mediastinum. So the mediastinum has the pericardial cavity plus the great blood vessels and the thymus gland above it. That's the center cavity. That's mediastinum. And the ones that your lungs are in are called the pleural cavities. Right and left pleural cavities. So you got thoracic cavity, the pleural cavities, the mediastinum, and then the inferior part of the mediastinum actually has the pericardial cavity as well. So we can subdivide cavities pretty easily. Okay, so that's it for the first chapter. So that's how we're going to do the whole course, pretty much. Right? So if you have questions over the instructor study guide right here, see me during office hours or listen to the lecture again and try to copy it down. Look at the notes. Because you know where I get these questions for the instructor study guide? Right from the lecture material. So that's probably, if you're confused, go right to the lecture material and see if you can find that information. Okay. All right, so that's it for chapter one. So I'm going to start chapter two. And chapter two is chemistry. So what the heck is chemistry? We learned what anatomy is, learned what physiology is. Here's another scientific discipline. And chemistry is the scientific study of the composition and the structure of substances. For instance, like chemicals. But also the reactions that they undergo. We're going to look at some chemical reactions. We're going to see how things happen. Okay, so that's what chemistry is. It's the structure of substances, but how substances interconvert from one form to another. So we're going to start with some basic definitions, like matter. What the heck is matter? Matter is anything that occupies space, like wood or plastic or even air. All right, that's matter. Liquids like water occupy space. Yeah, and of course we occupy space, so we matter. Okay. All right, so let's then break matter down into some building blocks. The most elemental form, the simplest form of matter is what we call an element. All right? And over on this table right here, we have a periodic table that shows all the different kinds of elements that can be in our world. And we have things like this O right here stands for oxygen. And this H right here stands for hydrogen. So that's pretty easy, some of these chemical symbols. There's a table in your book that tells you which of these elements are important for biology. There's only a handful that are important for biology. And I just want to show you which ones they are. Sometimes it's not really obvious what their name is because they don't come from English. They actually come from Greek. Right, so Greek is also an important language in anatomy and physiology. right? Because I guess it's a pretty old language. So H is important. That's hydrogen. Okay. This atom right here is very important. Na, but Na stands for sodium. Because in Greek, they call it natrium, right? So if you're Greek, it makes perfect sense. If you're speaking English, right, it doesn't make quite so much sense. Sodium is Na. Another real important one, potassium. That's K, because in Greek it's called kalium. Here's another important one, Ca. That's pretty easy. Calcium. Does everybody pretty much already know that calcium is pretty important for your body?
Yeah.
Probably, right? So calcium, Ca. Magnesium is also important. That's Mg. What are some others? Well, oxygen, we said, is real important. That's easy, O for oxygen. And then C is very important. And that's just carbon. That's really easy. Okay, so that's really good. Now, you have to have a little bit of some of these others. You got to have iron. Now, that's a tricky one because that's Fe. Iron is Fe. And what else? You have to have a little bit of sulfur, and that one is S. And a little bit of phosphorus, and that one is P. Okay, so phosphorus, don't get phosphorus and potassium mixed up because they both start with P in English, but not in Greek. All right. Okay, so those are the important ones. Those are all elements. So an atom is the smallest particle of an element. Like what is, I'll just point to this one. What's that? Oxygen, and that is
carbon.
Oh, here's one I didn't mention.
Nitrogen.
And that is nitrogen. And Na is
sodium.
K is potassium. And H is hydrogen. So those you definitely have to know. Okay, so if you just have one, we call that an atom. An oxygen atom is just one oxygen. But you know what? We can combine these things. We can combine an oxygen with carbon and maybe a nitrogen. And so if we take a number of atoms and put them together, we get something, the next complicated structure, and that is a molecule. So a molecule is a particle of matter composed of more than one atom, bound to each other by some kind of chemical bond. And you've probably heard of this, H2O. What's that?
Water.
That's water. And this chemical formula right here just says you have what? An oxygen and how many of the H's? You've got two hydrogens because H stands for hydrogen. That's water. Here is an oxygen molecule. And you know that's a molecule because you see that little 2 right there. So it's two atoms of oxygen coming together to form that molecule. That's what we breathe in our bodies. We need that to make energy. And then nitrogen is also a gas. That's a molecule because you see that 2 right there. So two atoms of nitrogen come together. The air that we're breathing is mostly nitrogen. And it really doesn't do much of anything for us. Right? It's not harmful. It's not helpful. It's just a gas that's in the atmosphere that we breathe in and out. And then look at this thing right here. You'll understand a little nomenclature in just a second. What is this? This is a carbon. And here is two hydrogens and an oxygen. And what's H2O?
Water.
So you have a water for every carbon. Sometimes we just call that carbon hydrate, carbon that's hydrated with a water. All right? And we don't really say that anymore. Instead of saying carbon hydrate, we say carbohydrate. Anybody ever heard of a carbohydrate? Yeah, that's a sugar, right? So here is a general form for sugar, CH2O. For every carbon atom, there's like a water molecule bound to it. And carbohydrates can have different number of carbon atoms. And in particular, this molecule of sugar has 6. So if you see this parentheses here, you just multiply this 6 to this oxygen, this 6 to the 2 for this hydrogen, and the 6 to that carbon. And so this would be what we call a 6-carbon carbohydrate, C6H12O6, and you see it written out here in the long form. So sometimes instead of writing it out long, we just pull that 6 out Okay. And this would be a really good example, for instance, of maybe a sugar that you've heard of, like glucose is a six-carbon sugar. All right, but that's where they get that carbohydrate from, right? Because it's a carbon that has that water molecule on it. So that's kind of fun to see. Okay. Well, you might be wondering, how is it that these different elements, why are these elements different from each other? So let's look at the structure of an atom. Let's look at some subatomic particles, and we'll see why those elements are different from each other. So here is a really nice picture. An atom is made up of three different kinds of particles. And that's all we have to really be concerned with in this class. And they're going to be found in two different locations of an atom. The locations of an atom are either the nucleus, which is on the inside, or on the outside. These outside parts right here are what we call orbitals, or sometimes we call them shells. All right, so you got two places of an atom, the nucleus or these orbitals over here. Inside the nucleus, you can have two different kinds of particles. You can have one that has a positive charge on it, and the particle that has a positive charge is what we call a proton. Or you can have another particle that's about as big and about as heavy, but it has no charge whatsoever. It's neutral. So guess what we call that particle? A neutron, which is right here. So protons and neutrons are always found where? Inside the nucleus right here. All right. And what's the second part of an atom? Not the nucleus, but it is the orbital right here. The kind of particle that you have in an orbital is always going to be an electron. And notice that the charge of an electron is different than a proton. It's what? Exactly opposite. It's negative. So you see a little negative sign right here. But the charge is exactly equal. So if we combine a proton and an electron, we get zero. They actually balance each other out exactly. All right, so that's what you have to know about the structure of an atom. The two places, the nucleus and an orbital. And inside the nucleus, you can either have protons or neutrons. And in shells or orbitals, you can only have electrons. That's the basic structure. So you could think of this maybe like our solar system with what's in the center of our solar system? The sun. And in orbit around the sun, you have planets. So you could use a planetary model to think of an atom. That's not a perfect way of thinking about it, but it's pretty good for this class. All right, so the sun in this particular case is a nucleus made of neutrons and protons, and the planets are these electrons that are circling the nucleus right here. Okay. So let's now answer that question that I posed before, and that is, what makes hydrogen different from, so here's hydrogen. What makes hydrogen different from helium? And what makes helium different from oxygen? And what makes oxygen different from carbon right here? It's pretty easy, right? And what makes these different elements different from each other is just the number of protons that are inside the nucleus. All right, so hydrogen right here only has one proton inside the nucleus. And when you look at this periodic table, what number do you see right there? One. So it tells you how many protons are inside the nucleus. That's kind of the fun thing about a periodic table. All right, and then we have a different element over here, helium. How many protons are inside the nucleus of a helium atom? There are two. And here is an element called lithium. It's not so important biologically, but it's used pharmacologically in our bodies. Lithium, how many protons are in the nucleus of a lithium? Three. And so this number right here, which corresponds to the number of protons inside the nucleus, is called the atomic number. So what makes elements different from each other, oxygen and carbon, is what? The atomic number, or the number of protons that are inside the nucleus. So I could give you a little test right now. I could show you this atom right here, and I could ask you, what's the name of this atom right here? How would you figure that out? Because it has three protons inside the nucleus. And you can look up at the periodic table, what atom has three protons inside the nucleus? Is it hydrogen? No. Is it helium? No, we don't have to go very far, just the next one, right? Which is lithium. Okay. So on the test, you know what? On the lecture test, I might actually give you a periodic table with the English words erased off of it. And I might ask you, what does this K stand for? And you would have to know that's potassium. And I could ask you, what's the atomic number? Or how many protons are inside the nucleus of potassium? And you're going to say 19, right there. So you're going to have the big letter and you're going to have the atomic number, but not the English word for that particular chemical. All right, so you have to be able to read the periodic table just a little bit. Oops. Let me kick it back on. Good. All right, so if lithium has three protons inside the nucleus, and then it's going to have exactly three electrons in orbitals around it. So if we add up all the electrons and all the protons, what's the overall charge of this atom right here? It's going to be zero. They're going to cancel out. Okay. And a lot of atoms like to exist in that neutral state. Okay. The other thing that we see, were you right? Yeah, there's lithium right there. Okay, good. Just to double check. All right, so how many orbitals, how many shells do you see right here? You see two. Okay. And so I'm going to tell you something about how electrons are added to these orbitals and to these shells. This first orbital right here can only have two electrons in it. The next orbital can have eight. Right, and the next one after that, it can have eight. Right, so that's how orbitals like to fill up. The first one is two, and then that's why this third electron is in the second shell, because is there room for this third electron in this first shell right here? There's no room. It gets booted out. Okay. So that's some important things to know about an atom. Let's take a look at this right here. Ah, some good quiz material. What kind of atom is this right here? You could tell me the name of this one. How do you know that's hydrogen? There's one proton inside the nucleus. Should we check? Good. What about this one here? Helium. Okay, and we see two electrons in that first orbital. And this one is our friend, the lithium, because it's got three protons inside there already. Okay. That works good for me. All right, my next slide. What does this look like here? Okay, tell me what atom this is. Okay. How do you know this is sodium? Because it has 11 protons inside the nucleus, and you can look at this periodic table right over here, and where's that 11 at? Oh, right here. 11 is Na, and you got to know Na stands for sodium. Okay. And we could count the protons inside the nucleus. Oh, but we can't. It just tells us. That's going to be 11. Good. And for sodium to be neutral, how many electrons should it have? It should have 11 electrons as well. Do we have 11? And are they filled in the shells according to the rules on how we fill shells in? Well, the first shell's only got two. Okay. And then the next one can have eight altogether. So 8 plus 2 is 10. So we got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. That's right. So this one is all filled in. All right. But you know what? That's only 10, but it's got to have 11 electrons. So the 11th electron has to go where? In the outer shell. All right. So and there it is right there. All right. Now, atoms are very comfortable when their outermost shell is completely filled with electrons. That's the only time that it is stable, that it feels comfortable in nature. All right, so what can you tell me about sodium? It's only got one in the outermost shell. So how's it feeling?
Unstable.
Very unstable. Even though it's neutral, it doesn't like to have that one electron in that outermost shell. And as a matter of fact, it would like to get rid of it somehow. Because then the outer shell would be what? Completely filled with electrons. And then it will be a very stable, happy kind of atom. Okay. So, something like that can happen very nice and easily. sodium can lose that electron. It can donate that electron to another atom. So what might be a possibility? What would be a good atom? What would be an atom that wants to accept an electron? Well, look at this atom right here. What is this one with the 11 protons inside of it? That's sodium. And let's look at, is that sodium? Gotta be. Okay. So that's sodium. And here is an atom that has 17 protons inside the nucleus. What is that? Okay, can you see that on the table over here? 17, 17. Probably not over here, probably over here someplace. Ah, right here. There's a 17. That's chlorine. Let's put the electrons in the orbitals for chlorine to see what we got. So 17 protons, it's got to have 17 electrons. So 2 in the first shell, 8 in the second, that's 10, right? So that means that there's going to be 7 left over to put in the third orbital over here. But how many can be put into this third orbital? Not 7, but 8. So it's what? It's missing one. So the chlorine atom is kind of unstable because it would like to accept an electron from somebody to fill up this other, this last orbital right here. And is this chlorine in luck? Is there an atom nearby in this particular case that wants to donate an electron to it?
Yeah,
this sodium right here. The sodium would love to get rid of that electron, and guess what? It can. It can come over here. All right. And when it does, guess what happens to the electrical charge of these two atoms? Since now sodium has lost an electron, it is what? A positive one, because it has lost that electron. And chlorine over here, since it's gained an electron, it is now a little bit negative. It's a negative one. Okay. And now these two things are stable. Both the sodium and the chloride are stable. And now let me just tell, is that a chlorine? Looks like a chlorine. Okay, good. Let me tell you something about electrical charges. Because they can either attract each other or repulse each other. And like charges repel each other, opposite charges attract. And since now the sodium and chlorine are opposite charges, guess what they like to do? They like to attract each other. All right, so sodium and chlorine, as these charged particles, attract each other, and that forms a little chemical bond that we call an ionic bond. Because ions are chemicals that have a little electrical charge on them, either a positive charge or negative charge. So we call this an ionic bond. And on the tip of your tongue, oh, here it says ionic bond. On the tip of your tongue, you should pretty much have a nice definition of what an ionic bond means in terms of these electrons. An ionic bond is when one atom donates an electron and another atom accepts an electron. And we're going to look at another definition of a covalent bond. It's got a little bit different terminology. Okay. So ionic is donating and accepting of electrons. And this kind of bond is relatively weak. It's a relatively weak kind of bond because you know what sodium chloride really is? It's table salt that you have on your table. And if you take some table salt, which is a nice white crystal, and you put it in water, guess what happens to it? It dissolves. Does it take a long time? No, right away. Right, it dissolves right away. It dissolves in solution right away because that ionic bond is very weak. It's so weak that water can break it, and then in the water you have the sodium that has a positive charge on it, and floating around separately is that chlorine that has a negative charge. And these things right here, like sodium with a positive charge and chlorine with a negative charge, we call these ions. So an ion is just a chemical that has an electrical charge associated with it. Yeah. I'm sorry? Oh, absolutely. Thank you. Yeah. Come back for the quiz, though. Okay. Oh, I clapped. The light went funny. Don't clap. Okay. So that's an ionic bond. When an electron is donated, Okay, and accepted by a different kind of atom.
Can sodium ever be a negative charge?
Sodium, it's not going to be stable. Maybe in a nuclear reactor or something, or an atomic collider machine, you could make a negative sodium, but it would be so short-lived that it has no significance for us.
But sodium by itself, not in a, like, if it's separate, it is technically negative, right? It still has that outer if it doesn't donate?
There has to be this chlorine nearby, okay? But sodium by itself is a metal, okay? You can have sodium atoms bound to other sodium atoms, and it's highly reactive. It will just burn into flames by itself with oxygen. So if you ever have sodium in a laboratory, it has to be underwater, so oxygen can't get to it. As soon as you take it out of the water, it just burns like a flare or something, okay? So by itself, it would be, you know, molecular sodium as a metal would not be charged. So this is where ions come from, okay, when these electrons move around. And you're going to see that that's very important in your body. You have a lot of sodium in your body. Potassium will be an ion. Magnesium will be an ion. And since it has an electrical charge, guess what an electrical charge in motion is? An electrical charge in motion is an electrical current. Okay, that's electricity. And so our bodies are very electrical because we have these ions that are moving around, and so our bodies are very electrical because of these ions right here. Ions can go by another name. Another name for an ion. Guess what? I'll just write down, what the heck is an ion? Yeah. Ion is, atom with electrical charge. It's an atom with an electrical charge. And it can either be what? A plus or a minus. And if it's an important ion in our bodies, we don't really call them ions, we call these electrolytes. So an electrolyte is an important ion that we have in our bodies. And again, these electrolytes are maintained via homeostasis within normal values. We have to have normal levels of sodium in our body and potassium and chloride. And maybe you've had a blood test where they actually measured these things. For sure they would on your grandma and grandpa, right? Because we're younger, we don't really have so much problems. But as you get older, people have troubles regulating their own electrolytes, like sodium, potassium, chloride, maybe even calcium, like this. Okay, so those are electrolytes. So we call those electrolytes because they have electrical properties because they have a charge on them. A lot of times in the emergency room, a patient might come in and a physician or somebody is going to say, we need some lights on this person right away. What does that mean? It's not like how it sounds, okay? It doesn't mean you should go get a lamp and shine light on them. It means you got to suck some blood out of this patient right away, take it to the lab and get their electrolytes measured, their sodium and potassium, because they're so important for the electrical properties of that person that their heart might stop, or C's or something like that, right? So an electrolyte is an ion, and this is how these ions develop, right? Because of these electrons that hop back and forth. All right, so next time, I'm going to start with the projector turning on and talking about a covalent bond, okay? So we're going to talk about covalent bonds too, because those are real important. So don't leave right now, because what do we got to do now? We got a quiz, that's right. So I'll turn my recorder off. So somehow you got to put your books away and all that kind of stuff.